What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. This time for the Heat 2 Book Club, I am your host, Blake Howard. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us here at One Heat Minute Productions. It is nice to be back in the saddle with you, talking about more Heat, talking about Heat 2, New York Times best-selling novel written by the one and only Michael Mann and, of course, Meg Gardner. This series is not a page at a time, no. It is not a chapter at a time, no. It is, in fact, a part at a time. There are 6 parts of Heat to the novel. This episode is a double breakdown featuring 2 of our most amazing, incredible crew members who've been here right from the beginning. One of them, a fantastic listener, and one of them, truly, the co-conspirator of this entire project. That's right, Stu Coote is back. You would have heard him throughout the series, one of the great minds talking about Heat, one of my dearest friends, a terrific cinematic film mind, former host of The Cinephiles, mostly heard, now popping up in guest spots and rum and rants on One Heat Meta Productions, joins us to kick off the show because it feels so appropriately in line with everything that we've done on One Heat Minute so far. And then I'm joined by a new friend, but a lifelong crew member, an obsessive One Heat Minute fan, one of the men who joined me in the first part of the finale of One Heat Minute, John P. Glynn. He is officially the Chief Meme Officer, CMO, of One Heat Minute Productions. And he's a phenomenal heat mind, a great, true Chicagoan, and someone who, as you would expect, loving One Heat Minute and loving Heat is a great chat around all things. So we're going to dive into part one, which we have also included the kind of Heat wrap-up prologue as well. So before we dive into that conversation with John, let's talk to my man, Stu Coote. Despite many people believing that this man can't read, I've enlisted him first up to talk about Heat 2 in our Heat 2 book club, largely because talking about something new to do with Heat feels sacrilegious not to have this man somehow involved. He helped us smash the champagne bottle on One Heat Minute. He's now here for the Heat 2 book club. He understands all of the fears and anxieties of such a thing existing in the universe. He is a dear friend. He helped me close out One Heat Minute before Michael Mann's episode, before a few sprinkled bonus episodes. It's Mr. Stu Coote. Welcome back to One Heat Minute. Welcome back to your hang.
It's a pleasure to be back. I feel like this is the 17th victory lap I've returned for. So this is good. It's a victory marathon.
It's now the victory marathon. But we can reveal here This is the first time I'm going to say it, and this is the best time I think I can say it for a recording. After the Heat 2 book club, One Heat Minute is retired.
Oh, thank goodness. Until they adapt this book into a miniseries.
No, they want to do it as a film.
Feature film.
They want to do it as a film. Yeah,
it'd play. I think it would play very well as a film. But, I say this each time. It's this project has brought out the very best and the very worst in you at most times. It's brought out the passion and the dedication, and you also can't let something just lie. You have to keep picking it up every 6 months and dusting it back off. Anytime someone looks sideways at Heat, you're going to be there dusting it off. You're going to be like the...
You just got to know how to grab it, Stu, and I know how to grab it. So that's why I'm there. I'm out there all night, dedicated. There's been a few instances where, you know, I've been compelled to talk about Heat coming back, talk about, you know, the experience of the screening and things like that and getting the band back together, so to speak, to do some of that stuff. That's been a complete blast. So some of those excuses are nice, but I feel like it's time. I feel like this is the last dance, we've done five rings, you know, on this project, and I feel like it's time to park it. I'm so excited and thrilled to continue to talk about contemporary man films and man cinema that we're doing over at Miami Nice. Katie Walsh and I continue to just have an absolute ball on that show. Our Collateral Confession sort of like parallel project that it's blooming is also just a complete blast. So I'm having so much fun talking about that and getting excited about new projects that are coming up that I feel like One Heat Minute, the show that I will always love and that has defined this entire project going forward in every iteration, has had some influence on how I approach it.
It's the namesake of your work as well.
It's who I am. But I feel like I'm gonna put it completely on hiatus, save for like something miraculous. But like, I feel like a Robert De Niro podcast might be 6 minutes, you know, like he would just go, what do you remember about this scene? Yeah, it was good. Cool. Yeah, what do you remember about this scene?
It was good. I made it. I was in that.
Do you remember anything else about this?
No. I'm not even sure I was in it.
I think the intro for the Robert De Niro One Heat Minute would be longer than the show.
Yeah, I think it'd be like him on extras. That'd be him. That'd be the show. That'd be the whole thing.
Maybe I need. But
it's interesting. It was fun thinking of like De Niro being on my mind as I'm still working my way through the book. Now I'm getting haunted with images of young De Niro and young Pacino, and I don't hate that idea as I'm going through it. Have they done much press? I've stayed away from the launch of it. I don't know if you did. Have they actually sort of defined the roles of what man and like how they sort of broke up the writing duties? Have they sort of gone into much detail about that?
Yes and no. I think what was happening is that the broadcast about it was that Meg and Michael Mann, Meg Gardner, that is, who is his co-writer, wrote the book, and it was almost like they were passing the baton between one another. Like Mann had rigorously outlined the story and knew very specifically certain elements that he wanted to cover. And then it feels like, especially in the more expansive sections, that Meg was there to help with a crime writer's brain plot and take us through those things and like flesh out of all those ideas and narrativize them, because some sections feel like they're so coherently man and others feel more like they're a bit more languid and it is truly a blend of styles. So I think they've done a bit of Lennon McCartney. They haven't sort of said what's what. And yeah, I think it might take till later, you know, the Peter Jackson 7-hour multi-series documentary to talk about who exactly contributes to what and see how there's a rhythm or rhyme with that. Get back. But I think the more that you read it, I think there's some certain like Michael Mannisms that feel like, oh, these chapters or this idea or this piece of interiority is very Michael Mann. And then when
there's larger set pieces and plotting and how things go through, it's like the connective tissue feels very Meg. It doesn't feel, and there's, you can sort of sometimes feel a bit of a stylistic, you know, contrast between those two things, but they haven't gone to the detail of that. And I would hazard to say, as you know, as One Heat Minute fans know, we knew about this book at the time that we're making One Heat Minute, right? So like 2016 to 2000, you know, 2017 to 2019, we knew this book was being written. We knew, we even spoke to Reed Farrell Coleman. And I know you and I have talked offline excitedly about the prospect of all that stuff that we heard, stuff that wasn't published because at the time it wasn't right to publish it. And I didn't want to share it and spoil anything that I'd learned. But I feel like so much of it was close. I just don't think they broke it. I think they mapped out where they wanted to go. They just hadn't quite done the ins and outs. So then once Meg came in, they probably took whole sections out, rewrote stuff, reorganized parts, figured out a bit of a rhythm for how they were going to tell the story. And then they sort of filled in all the gaps. So yeah, because it's been a working, you know, it's been a work in progress really for, you know, strangely enough, the time that they started writing Heat 2 tracks basically at exactly the same time that you and I were drunk in a Sydney Film Festival hotel room talking about doing this project. So it all sort of, there was a coalescence, I think. And, but it hasn't been mapped out specifically. No.
Because at times it feels like a sort of a beefy screenplay or like a script kind of thing in its writing. And that sometimes sort of feels like that's the sort of very, the man structure in it. Because even it may be just because we've watched the film so many times and watched his work so many times, you pick up the rhythms of his editing and it feels like it's there in the writing as well. It feels like it's written, like the cuts in action feel very much like almost, because man's like, I think he leans more to a sort of a, like his background of like a TV style editing, like it's short, sharp action. It's not like even like not standing some of the action sequences in the heat, but most of it is like these real controlled bursts of aggression and violence and passion and pleasure. It's not an extended process like other or authors really go into, like draw everything out. Whereas this has a real sort of perfunctory nature about it, which I found fascinating to read. It's not overly descriptive in its prose, which again is sort of mirrors a lot of his storytelling generally.
Like it's economical, right? Yeah. Like I feel like you would have had the very similar experience to me, is that we're so familiar with this text, particularly you watch it, the film Heat, we've watched it countless times. You read the book and I feel like almost this book had this weird experience where I'm reading some parts of it and I'm like, okay, this is the director scene direction instruction portion of the page where it tells me how to establish the scene and where we are and sets it. And then it's like, bang, dialogue, 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 movement, movement, pace. And you're like, now I've had the scene set and now I'm in the scene. And then it reads like a script. Sort of, it's got that economy.
Sort of getting, it's like the making of in a strange way. I was really worried going into it that I was going to get, because I was fairly burnt by Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Once Upon a Time, I always feel it like, I feel like Tarantino wrote that in a way, this is my cynical view, that he wrote it in a way that someone would read the book and then watch his movie and go, no, the film was better than the book. And so in
many people
strange,
had that, many people read the book and went, this is, you know, some part, there's some great additional scenes, particular scene with Steve McQueen and Rick Dalton talking in a bar later in the book.
Yeah.
Super great. There's a couple of great, you know, interactions, Rick and his co-star. There's a couple of like these scenes that are so iconic that flesh things out a little bit more, etc. Then there are other parts you're just like, I don't like this and I didn't need it. And therefore the conclusion at the end of it is like, I don't think I'll ever read the book again, but holy shit, if Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is on any time of the day or night, I'll watch it.
Yeah, it's probably his best film.
Yeah.
So, and there was just something that he sort of, if you then looked at the film, he then cut so much out of the book and rewritten scenes, and you're like, oh, yeah, this filmmaker knows this text better than this author does.
Yes.
I was worried that we were going to get too much of that over-explaining, too much depth in this, but like the way this just feels like such a continuation of these characters in such simple ways, like Vincent going to the hospital, like going to the young girl's hospital bed.
Yes.
And when he's like when he, because it's so similar to sort of the talking about his dreams.
Yes.
With Neil, that you sort of go, all right, I can extrapolate back to this time and what you're trying to say. It's almost like this sort of mystical quality, and there's the way that he's talking to this comatose victim. I really like those touches. And I was worried as well originally how they were setting it around Chris, because Chris was such a, you know, he's an interesting character generally, but he's a bit of a, I don't know, like almost like a blank, like that blankness to him, that blank stare, that coldness. I didn't think you'd actually be able to grasp too much of more of a character onto him than we sort of experienced.
Like, yeah, because Kilmer relishes the wordlessness, right? He's just like, yeah, in it, and he's so absent,
he's an absent person. He's not like, I always think about, and one scene keeps going through my head every time I'm reading this book, when they bust the LAPD watching them, and when like Chris is just there and he's like, just says, oh, maybe it's the score they're on, not us. But he says it in this way that's so, like, he's so vacant.
Maybe it's the score they're on, too, the place, not us. Because it's been hit a couple of times, you know, something.
Assume they got our phones, assume they got our houses, assume they got us right here, right now, as we sit, everything, assume it all.
How are we going to buy the bank package from Kelso?
I'll front that. That's not a problem.
Well, what the hell happens to Van Zandt or 750?
Van Zandt, listen, with the heat we got, you want to play World War II in the streets with Van Zandt?
No, I want my 750, and when he gets a pass?
I got more motivation to whack Van Zandt than either of you. He is a fucking luxury. Our problem is take the bank or split right now. Do not go home, do not pack, nothing. 30 seconds flat from now, we are gone on our separate ways. That's it, Chris.
The bank is worth the risk. I need it, brother. Should stay and take it down. That's where I come out.
Like, no, like, he's just so, like, just goes with this current. And in this, you sort of get that there is a bit more of a driving force to him, which I guess we would expect, because we are spending a lot more time in his head. And I was worried initially when it starts and how they sort of get him out of the city. I was worried, but once it settles into its rhythm. And then the time, like, I was worried about the time jumping around as well. And it's seamless. It's really special. Like, this is something, I don't know if we'll ever get, I don't know who could step into these shoes. I think it'd be really hard to do. I think it could be really interesting. I'd love to see someone try and like adapt this as almost like some kind of animated thing, yes. Like in a way, just to sort of have to sidestep around the argument of like, who, like, de-aging versus recasting. I wish there was a way to sort of find some, and it would never happen, obviously, but just like a happy medium of like trying to find it.
And it's not because it can't be done, but it's because we have just been so, you know, Stu is an unabashed Star Wars fan. And on this show, I can say, look, we have that in common, but we try so hard. I mean, Stu's more of an antagonistic prick about it, which is very amusing to Star Wars fandom and discourse just in general. But I feel bad for the discourse just around it. I feel like it's going to be so tiresome. The minute that if Michael Mann aspirations come true here and they make this into this gigantic epic film and he recasts these characters and he does what he needs to do to make this work, I just imagine that the discourse is going to be so tiring and tiresome by the time that the film is actually made that I can almost hear myself already going, like, why are you doubting Michael Mann? Like, why are we doing this? Like, what are we doing? Yeah. Like,
it'd be so hard to, like, it would just be so hard to do. I don't know what the, like, without going, you'd almost have to sort of cast it with like sort of relatively unknown theater actors who are untested on screen, just to give some degree of like this, especially these eras, like to find
an 88 De Niro, 88 De Niro and a 2000 De Niro.
Yeah. Like they don't, I don't even know who would be like, no one even really has now the, not many actors even now have the physicality of these guys. The sort of, like you sort of think of like, it would almost be what? Midnight Run era De Niro.
That's who it is, like 100%.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, it's not schlubby De Niro, but it's definitely...
He's not like shredded. Sort of, he's actually, no. His peak physical condition was two films, Cape Fear. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Raging Bull first, obviously in his younger career.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before he then blew himself up for the purposes of that role.
Yeah.
Then he does Cape Fear and he looks unbelievable. Like Max Cady is such an amazing character and he's meant to look like a freaking swole prison.
Like he's been in prison. Yeah.
Like a prison guy who's just like, he's just tortured his body to death basically to do all that. So that's amazing. But then you've got him that transitions into Heat and he takes away all of that like superficial swole muscle, but he's very lean, muscular, tough. Like even Ace Rothstein in Casino, which he makes right around the same time, he's covering up his physicality in all these like glorious robes and huge oversized
suits. Yeah,
and
hiding behind the cigarette, like literally hiding behind the cigarette nearly most of the time. And it's sort of detracts from the fact that he does look that like he still looks like a whippet.
Yes.
Like when you see him when he gets out of bed with Edie, like he's still a really slender guy. It's almost like, you know, Clooney in The American. Kind of like just super small for what they are. Yeah.
And it's the same thing with like the other great example is, and I learned this making Zodiac Chronicles, like Daniel Craig in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo came off a Bond film. And so they have to dress him in these big coats and these loose fitting, scarfy, sweatery looking gear because they have to kind of hide like his natural lean athleticism and go, oh, this guy could be a believable journalist. Whereas, you know, he's just coming off Bond where he looks phenomenal. Like he's in peak physical condition.
Yeah, it's a curse on nearly all. Like it's why I can't accept like Hemsworth and The Rock in most things because they've designed that's their persona and it's very hard. Like you look at Al, like Pacino is not going to really be doing much shirt off work in Heat. You know what I mean? Like it's never that's not that style. And they even then the young version of him is still not exactly like it's not a MCU body sort of thing, which is. You know, and I don't know who you get to, again, recasting that would be, like, who, and then for them not just to do just a parody of those younger versions as well, which is almost impossible. But I don't know who's coming up to do it. Part of me wants to see them have a crack at this because there is a story there. And, yeah, sure, this would still have to get pruned back a fair bit.
I think so much of it melts away, mate. You know, what we're talking about precisely is that, like, Michael Mann can tell so much of this story visually that in a book you actually have to write the words. And when you actually, and especially part three, which is the sort of the central crisp part of the story, and even the Chicago stories, the setting of the scene, the contextualizing of the places, the way that different characters feel, the way they enter, exit, behaviors, so much of it just melts away from the text because he just shows everything. You know, when you're in a fixer's garage who does nothing but like get you cars in Chicago of 1988, there's no one who knows Chicago in 1988 like Michael Mann. So he just makes it happen. He just makes it happen. It just looks like that. It feels like that.
It's definitely page turner. Like I hope it doesn't just, and I don't think it will. I hope it's not just going to become another airport book. Like I actually hope it is a book that people actually find. Like I think people search it out because I think there's so much good in here that just speaks back to the film, stands on its own, and just enriches the characters. I'm like, I've got about 200 odd pages to go. I'm going to smash through it shortly. And then I'm really looking forward to going back and revisiting the film again. So
thank you for one thing that I want to say to you. Thank you for saying the one thing that I was most scared of and also would have been so overwhelmed by. You like, imagine if the thank you at the beginning of the book or the dedication is for Blake. I was like, no, it can't be. It would be too much, Stu. It would be too much. And thankfully it wasn't. I was like, yeah, oh God. Oh, yeah. I don't know if I can live with that. I don't know if I can live with that pressure.
I was going to do it just as Vance to write it on my one. Just be like, I don't know if your one has it, but my one definitely does. Love it. Yeah, it's sort of one thing that stuck with COVID. I think it hurt Tenet, not just the discourse on the film itself, but we sort of lost that PR of having, I think it would have been interesting to have Christopher Nolan out actually having to press the flesh and to be talking about it constantly and walk and people hitting him up and actually like asking questions about like just going through some of those key decisions he's made and seeing if they hold up to the scrutiny, whichever way you come down on it. And it's one thing that with COVID, I don't know if we got too much of man being out on the tours like he would have been, because it's sort of, this is tail end when everything was sort of opening back up, but
Meg were out there. They were out there. But I think also the blessing for us as movie fans is that the primary reason that Michael Mann had limited access to people around the time of its release, and look, it ended up being a New York Times bestseller and one of the biggest selling books of the year anyway, but he was making Ferrari. And so we're all like, look, he did a few shows, he did, you know, a few big shows, and there was a few things promoting the book and people were getting excited for it. But at the same time, a lot of us film fans were like, you know what, Michael, please don't talk. Instead, go and film Ferrari.
Yeah.
Go film Ferrari.
Like, work. Chop.
We're so excited about that. And so that's what I'm actually really looking forward to, a new Michael Mann feature that is going to be born into existence. And then, you know, what I will absolutely get tired of all of the speculative nonsense that's going to happen and fuel 1,000 different posts on a whole bunch of sites that have done absolutely no research and recycle each other. But I will be very excited about seeing if this actually gets turned into a film, and the idea that he is still making movies and still has the vitality and the energy to do so. I'm really looking forward to seeing Ferrari to see how that all shapes up.
Yeah, no, it's still exciting times. So that's why I'm not accepting you or never say never again.
I'm just going to say that right now it's going back on the shelf. There will be no new One Heat Minute episodes for the conceivable future. This is my last dance. I'm really looking forward to bringing people modern man in our other shows, and particularly moving on to some really exciting future projects. And stretching everything that we do, because I've been so blessed with the reward of the community going with us on all of our different tangents and going to new movies and joining us on journeys like All the President's Minutes, which we did straight after. So I'm really thrilled and excited to see what the next year holds. But this series, very much, Stu, is going to be all about us talking about the Heat 2 book. Thank you for helping me introduce this particular episode. And the start of the series. And, you know, it wouldn't feel the same if you weren't here.
My pleasure.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
the chief meme officer of One Heat Minute, one of the great Heat fans, a man who I shared the most unhinged Q&A of Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, hosted by Bilge Ibiri. And really, I just want to thank him for bearing witness to, I don't know, the thirstiest like eight women in New York City for Al Pacino's current look and state. He's one of my favorite people in the world. It's John P. Glenn. John, welcome live from Chicago to talk to me about a book that I know you were panicked once you received that galley copy, almost panicked to read, just as I was. Oh my God, here it is. It's finally here. This continuation of what we consider to be a sacred text. How are you?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Good to see you again. And yeah, when last I left you, you were getting in a cab outside of a deli in New York where we just had a bagel with Minnie Mouse and Spider-Man. Times Square performers.
That's a great diner. I love that diner.
So it was good. Good call by Jordan, I think, right? it was a great surprise when we went to the screening. I did not know or expect that we would be getting a copy of that night. And I actually saw someone in the bathroom with one tucked under their arm. And I'm like, is that an early copy of the novel? And I just thought he was a reviewer that maybe, you know, and he's like, yeah, there's a stack of them on a table downstairs. And I was like, what? So yeah, very eager and glad to finally having gone through it and being able to discuss it with a fellow disciple.
Look, you're the funnest, because when John's doing anything, he does memes on the other side of the world that I wake up to. It's like a waking up present all the time. And then when he was reading the book, I was getting voice memos in my text messages that were you doing impressions of Al Pacino, Vincent Hanna, lines from the book. I was getting in voice memos, which I still have. So they may feature on the show. You might just hear yourself in multiple mediums.
What are you not going to tell me about Chris Chehalis? What are you not going to tell me about Chris Chehalis? What are you not going to tell me about Chris Chehalis?
But we're here talking about the first... We're tackling the prologue in part one, and everyone that I'm talking to in the book club, I'm kind of getting them to nominate their favorite part of the book, or, you know, you might have multiple favorite parts, but like different parts of the book that really resonated with them. And I'm really interested, firstly, like just overall, was it an overarchingly positive experience for you, or a negative experience, like what the book itself? Because I'm just interested that, I guess, as overall, and then we'll dive into why you specifically chose this section to unpack with me.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, overarching positive. I think with most of the, you know, with most of the fans and most of the One Heat Minute world, you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who just really didn't like it. I mean, I think it would have had to really have, you know, swung and missed to not at least have, you know, a diehard Heat fan come away pretty satisfied, both with Mann and Meg Gardner's ability to take the story further, but also to sort of drill down and elaborate on some of the backstories that, you know, Michael Mann obviously had planned long before even, you know, shooting a frame of the film 25 to, you know, almost 30 years ago now. Overall quite positive. You know, there were certain parts I liked better than others. Some of the real technical aspects of the dark web stuff, I have to say, I would read and reread until my eyes kind of glossed over it. I would eventually just, you know, barrel through and be like, all right, I trust that I won't have to remember. I hope this won't be on the test, basically. Like, I think I understand what this means, but I'm going to see how it plays into the story, and I'll bookmark it and go back if I have to. But yeah, and then the section I asked when you kindly invited me to be part of this project was actually the opening section, which I thought, for anyone who knows me as a very slow reader, especially of fiction, that it would be, because it's the shortest section and the first section, and like that's as far as I got. But I promise I didn't finish. But I did mention a preference for talking about the prologue and the first section, which kind of takes us up to the day or day and a half after after the bank heist, and gets us to where Chris is first crossing over into Texas in 95. And I think the reason why was, you know, I think being such a diehard fan of Heat, that, you know, anything that expands on the property that we know and love so well, and for as great as the ending of the film is, you know, you can't not also wonder, like, what happens to Chris? I mean, if there were three people that survived and they all kind of went their separate directions, you might say, like, and, you know, and they all lived happily ever after in their own way. But there was only one, you know, last man standing, and kind of, you know, the effort he already made to reconnect with his old life that didn't go as planned. But it's like, so now he's just out in the wind. And on the flip side, for as much closure as it seems like there was for Hannah on the runway there, you also know that, you know, once the, you know, the forensics team shows up and clears out Neil's body and everything else, like, all he's thinking about is, you know, getting the guy that killed Bosco, or at least, you know, contributed to Bosco and all the other LAPD deaths that day. So, you know, so you knew there were still a lot of wheels in motion when those credits were rolling, and what happened and where did they go? So.
From the prologue. In the chaos of the Far East bank robbery, Braden was killed at the wheel of a Lincoln by Hannah's detectives Drucker and Casals. Chirito, shooting himself with a 5-year-old, was shot through the head by Hannah. Hannah's partner Bosco was gunned down by Chehalis. 3 uniformed LAPD were dead and 11 wounded, 3 seriously. Chehalis was hit above his body armor by a 5.56mm round traveling at 3,100 feet per second. It slammed into the ground and shattered his clavicle, sending the bone shrapnel through his upper thorax. Neil half carried him into a supermarket parking lot where he carjacked a station wagon. They had to get the hell out of LA. Neil never made it. Hannah killed him under the approach lights at the foot of an LAX runway. Edie was waiting for him in a Camaro on the driveway next to the Airport Marquee Hotel on Century Boulevard. Only Chris Chehalis survived.
While it's like a philosophically satisfying and deeply unsatisfying moment in that perfect harmony with him and Neil, like, you know, I think in the opening part of this book, he describes like feeling the pulse in his hand and feeling the tremors in his body. And you're like,
the paroxysms, as I had.
And the, you feel that, but then also it's like, okay, well, we act to close this case. We need to find the money. Like they did steal like $13 million. So everyone's dead. The money is gone and one guy is left. And so we have to do everything we can to do it. And so, yeah, I think that that's, it's like the, you're still treading firmly in settings we've been before, but we're seeing them from different perspectives. We're seeing characters interact that have never interacted before. We're seeing, you know, we're seeing video surveillance footage of a beautiful woman checking out Neil reading Stress Fractures in Titanium, which I know that you're a big fan of. And so there's that whole part. I think that, you know, when you were telling me that this is the section, I, knowing you a little bit, I'm like, I know why, you know, this is us getting to probe still very much in our world, you know, before the world expands. And sometimes it's like, you know, that's the mastery of Heat, is that it's this massive world and then it brings everyone really close together. And then in parts of the book, it kind of has to scatter them across the world and do different things and those sorts of things. And we take people away from our orbit, but then the end of the book rationalizes and sort of gets them all back together again. And we get to our climax, but here we're still very much like dancing with the world that we very, very clearly understand.
Yeah. I was even thinking, you know, you could almost consider it like, just imagine that back in 94, 95, that man shot, that this was all part of the script.
Yes.
Man shot everything. Cause I mean, you could see a world where the movie ends with Chris drifting into Mexico, and like that's closure for us. Like, we don't know what happens to him exactly, but we know he got out, you know, and maybe he reconnects with Charlene, maybe he doesn't.
Yeah, but it feels like it could be like a, you know, a post, I don't know what, I exactly. can't think like of the movies, like, yeah, like a mid-credits, like the credits like are rolling.
Right.
Yeah, the credits are rolling on one side of the screen and fucking.
So just a world where man shot all this and edited it and said, you know, holy shit, this movie's 4 hours. We have to cut this down a bit. So
yeah, like the people in Warner Brothers are like, Michael, you've just shot the longest credits ever because this 20-minute coda that you're playing alongside the credits cannot exist.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, I got to take it out. But that's the, yeah, I absolutely have the same sort of feeling when I read this with, you know, as well. When I read it, I was like, I'm back in the world again.
Yes. And I'm glad that we started there. Cause I, you know, we've known for a while that this was going to be a prequel sequel, and I wanted to get the prequel and backstory and all that. But I was hoping they would drop us, you know, into LA the day after the robbery to sort of see what happens. And that that's exactly what happened. And you mentioned the time span of the movie. We do get a little bit of a hint, although it's vague, that I don't think I really put together until I was sort of rereading the section for our chat here, that when they're going through Edie's apartment, or I'm sorry, when they're still in Neil's house, Drucker's got the stress fractures book, and he says he bought it last month.
Yeah.
We know that the robbery was on the 7th. So, I mean, last month could be 8 days ago. Last month could be 3 weeks ago. Like, we're not too sure, but there is some, you know, something that sort of narrows it down at least to that.
We know that at a maximum it's a month.
Yes. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah, exactly. We know now that at least it's a maximum of a month. We've had the theory that it's as little as 7 days, but it's,
and,
yeah.
Well, and you know, if you really drill down, think about like in 1995, how many days worth of surveillance would a random bookstore have, you know, have kept, you know, easily accessible that they're able to rouse the manager and she's able to find, you know, within. So we assume it's at least within a couple, you know, say a retail place keeps up.
A couple of weeks. Yeah.
So that helps our investigation.
Did you like that essentially, and this is what I say when I say that this book is at its best and sometimes is other times challenging, is because it's like the richest appendices of our favorite film ever. You know, like it's like, as much as it's a sequel and a prequel, it's like, especially this is like an appendices for everything that we know, you know, the 100%. Immediate fallout and the fact that Vincent goes to, you know, I immediately visualize it. I'm like, Vincent is standing where Neil stands when he does that famous Alec Colville painting.
Yes. And he's touching the window.
Note.
He mentions, and there's even a passage about his left hand touches the glass. Or yes. I mean, I think he says his right hand touches
his
the
right
glass.
Hand touches the glass. And so it's an inverse.
And I went to look up the painting, and sure enough, it was De Niro's left hand. So it's like, once again, they're the yin and yang.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I loved it. I caught myself a few times, you know, just when I first read it, you know, the dialogue and everything, like my brain kept going, God, whoever wrote this really has the rhythm of Heat down. I'm like, oh yeah. That would explain, like who knows Heat as well as someone as well as me, who's seen it dozens of times. But, oh, the guy who wrote and directed it. Sure. That makes sense. Story checks out.
Yeah. It's that, that was fun about the first few, you know, the first week when a few people had got their hands on it. You know, I was enjoying our friend Sean Burns' tweets because he was just like pulling random Vincent Hanna quotes out of the book and tweeting it. Yeah. And everyone was getting very excited. Like, it's like, I love this shit. Like, I love thinking of Pacino. Because, you know, he's so vivid in our minds that we don't need to do like Disney and like digitally recreate him. Like the ghost of Al Pacino as Vincent Hanna haunts our brain and says lines in our head every day. So, you know, when he's got a few new quotes, it's good stuff.
For as, you know, for as much speculation as there'll be about casting a film version, I kind of hope I'd be happy with a CGI Pacino with the hackiest stand-up comedian who just does an impeccable Pacino impersonation. Like, that's good for me. I'll be happy with that. And in places like not only in appendices, but it's almost like, I mean, especially the prologue where they're recounting the bank heist, it's almost it's almost like a cut and paste montage of the script where, you know, Nate's where they're almost, you know, kind of accidentally quoting Nate's line about two telcos and a cellular and describing the armored car heist in the beginning, how, you know, when he's when they talk about how they ignored the loose cash, which you can't not hear in Ted Levine's voice, like they ignored the loose cash.
They ignored the loose cash. So good.
And whether when they're talking about the location of the bank down on Flower and Figueroa. The line about when Neil first finds that, you know, when Neil picks up that there's the heat is around the corner, basically. When he his first reaction was calm and smooth because smooth was fast. Fast wasn't fast. Like it seems kind of corny at on first read, but then you read it and you're like, you know exactly what he's trying to convey, you know, as anyone who's watched Neil work. That, you know, fast for fast's sake is sloppy and can get out of hand, but the fast wasn't fast. I like that.
There's a poem at the beginning of part one.
The Spoon Jackson. Yeah.
Spoon Jackson. And so if you don't know Spoon Jackson, so Stanley Russell Spoon Jackson was a Californian poet and wrote all of his poetry from San Quentin prison. And then eventually, you know, it was San Quentin in the 80s and then California State Prison. And the quote is, and I may be wrong, but there's not really any other poems that sort of start any of the other openings. It's just kind of like this particular one, and it kind of sets the scene. And I feel like this is such a Michael Mann thing, that someone who has done a lifetime of prison and has this institutionalized mindset is someone who completely resonates with his vision of the guys that fascinate him. And he says, realness eats raw meat and does not waver. He has the staying power of the sun. He walks only in his own shoes. And so that is not Neil McCauley, that poem. For me, that poem is a Chris Chehalis.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that's Chris Chehalis's epitaph. You know, that's his, that's who he is. Realness eats raw meat. That's, you know, he's an instinctual beast, if you like. Yes. And that's where we start. So we're in Los Angeles in 1995. Take me through some of your scribbles. Take me through some of the things that you love about this opening.
Well, I like the prologue, especially, like I've said, it's sort of a montage. I like the when they're talking about how Vincent, you know, sort of was tipped off about Neil's crew to begin with. It said, like, working his network of informants, which was sort of a very professionally generous description of sitting down with Tone Loc and, you know, and almost missing it. If Tone Loc hadn't said slick as he stands up, like there might be no story. So in a way, it sounded like maybe Vince wrote that part of the prologue. It's
an advertorial for the work that you did.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I like the sort of, and I think I probably missed him on first reading or, you know, glanced over him. I don't know how anybody couldn't have a couple little insights, you know, we call it foreshadowing, if you like, when he's describing how Edie, you know, sort of affected Neil. She opened a door that he thought was closed. It was closed on like a bloody highway in Mexicali.
Yes.
Like that's, you know, I didn't mentally bookmark that when we first read the prologue thinking like, oh, I bet we're going to hear more about that. Like I, you know, maybe that was just, I thought just a, not a throwaway, I mean, nothing's throwaway in here, but just like a minor detail that, you know, there's no way to realize that we get some follow-up on that in the chapters to come. It almost like gives, not almost, it definitely gives a little background to those, including myself, who, you know, maybe say one of the flaws of Heat is the, I believe people's argument who say they don't buy the romance between Neil and Edie. Like it seems sort of contrived for the story, but then when you hear, again, you would never know this just watching the film, but when you get some of this backstory about what's happened to him in the past and who he's lost in the past, Like, I think that, you know, lends weight to their relationship and how, you know, she just kind of came out of nowhere. He wasn't looking for it. He wasn't expecting it, anything like that.
But it was something that was missing for him.
Yes.
That's what the book reframes.
Yeah. And some other cool little insights. Like, I don't think I knew until reading the book that Charlene's wave off was specifically a blackjack gesture. I mean, yeah. I knew what he took it to mean and what it was supposed to mean. But the fact that that, you know, ties back to their first meeting in Vegas and things, that was a cool little detail for me, as was, I never noticed that when after the abandoned metal heist, that they meet outside of a giant like power transformer.
Yes.
To ward off the possibility that they might be, you know, the trackers in the car might still be throwing a signal.
Yeah, that was a nice little detail, because, you know, it just feels like another fantastic LA location for LA location's right. sake, but you don't. Yeah, exactly. I certainly didn't put that together, that a power transformer at that time with 1995 technology would screw with police surveillance or work vehicles or whatever the case may be. But it makes sense, because they know that they're got at that point,
right? And it, you know, it fits right in, you know, thematically with a chop shop or the shipping warehouse where you know, where they do the sort of where they get made, the LAPD. It was good. Did you feel like you picked up any new insights to the film?
At least
through the prologue.
The prologue, that would be the major one, the Mexicali stuff. And for me, it's and it's just details about the specifics of different cars and choices. And I just love one of my favorite phrases, because Michael Mann has said it for decades. He's just like, and it's a Chicagoism. So talking to you, it's the thing when I went back and made a note, was like, the line is, at the same time, each would blow the other out of his socks with no hesitation. And I'm like, that's such a Chicago Dennis Farina, Charlie Adamson line. Like, they'll blow each other out of their socks, you know, like that's but no, this for me, when I was reading it, this is one of the like speediest things, because it was just like, I was actively editing the montage of this movie in my head when I was reading it. I was like, oh, this is the way that you cut, you front load a movie that is Heat, and you take these key snapshots to bring people back into the story, this full immersion. And it has to be like blisteringly quick, but it has to be rich with, I guess, the philosophy of what the movie is. And it does both. It says like, look at how good these crews are, but also this is the philosophy, and these are why these guys ran head to head, and these are why they were worthy opponents, I guess, is where I was going with that.
Another parallel I was thinking of, when the when Vincent is in Neil's house, that there was the one bottle of single malt on the counter, which is the same as the bottle of Jack that Vince always reaches for. We learn later Neil's also got vodka in the fridge, so he's got a wide range of cocktail preferences.
A wide range, the smallest wide range of all time. Barely anything. The same three shirts, the same suit, wears all the time.
That's like the. Wasn't Steve Jobs had that, and like Zuckerberg? And I always think of the Jeff Goldblum fly too. Doesn't Gina Davis make some comment about how he's got like the same suits in his closet? And since the pandemic and working from home, I was like, I bet my neighbors think I have the six different gray hoodies and jeans. Like, nope, same one. I did like some specific callbacks that I made a note on. Anything in this bullshit sterile white with seagull shit on the windows place tells you who the fuck that might be. Like, that's the dead tech postmodernistic bullshit now. Like, Vincent Hanna has architectural opinions.
Drucker hands him the book. Great reading list, cold, clinical shit. A price tag is stuck to the back. Hennessy and Ingalls, you know this place? Santa Monica, yeah. It's an art and architecture bookstore. Hannah flips through the heavy stock pages. A receipt is stuck inside. Bought the book last month. Paid cash. The roll of the surf seeps through the windows. Hannah holds up the receipt. Drucker's already dialing. Haul the manager's ass in right now. Neil was in that store 3 weeks ago buying this. Who was with him? Who waited on him? Who cashed him out? Drucker heads out the door. Hannah stands there in front of the ocean.
That's a great detail because it feels to me like Neil keeps the receipt, not because he's accounting for some of his purchases right. to write it off on tax. It's more of like he's going to read this book, and when someone in the bookstore throws a receipt in there, he's not. It's one element of what he's doing that, like, he doesn't care. If right. that record is there, like he feels like a guy who buys a book to read a chapter, a very mm-hmm. focused chapter specifically on what he's about, and then he moves on. But this is what leads to a fantastic scene where they go to the bookstore.
And, yes,
and Pacino spots Edie.
Yeah, that leads to that scene. Before that, we go back to Nate and Chris a little bit, right?
Yes, we do.
And it occurred to me, like, I think I appreciated anew the sort of the risk Nate is taking by continuing to, you know, shelter Chris. Because obviously he left once already.
Yes.
And then came back. And selfishly, Nate could have easily, you know, kept that share of the bank heist and, cut him loose. So it's you get the feeling that maybe he's doing it somewhere between, like, out of respect for Neil or to almost, like, try to get it right where Neil got it wrong. Like, I tried to tell Neil, to follow the code, and he didn't, and look what happened, and he's just trying like hell to keep Chris on it. He can't make him. It's a free country, brother. But but he, he certainly tried. And I had that. There's no way this was intentional. But when Nate is trying to get Chris up and moving, it reminded me of like Han finding Luke Skywalker on Hoth, where he's just like, instead of Yoda, Dagobah, he's like, Charlene, Dominic, no, gotta go. He's trying to nurse him.
But also I think that's a good point. Nate is in this world and Nate has loyalties and life or death. The tragedy of Nate keeps going for me because it's like he's a custodian of all of these. He's either a custodian of these guys who are living on the other side of the law and helping them navigate this naturally sort of closing noose of like police attention that eventually dissipates, and knowing and he's happy to wait the long game. Like, this is a guy who's probably been in prison for many years before he came out and has a record and has contacts and all that sort of stuff and can navigate the way through the system. But he's also then duly obligated that he's got stashes of money or spare places mm-hmm. or different locations that he can stash stuff. And he's like, yeah, I've got a few places around that definitely aren't in my name. And I paid someone off to give me the place and give me a key. And so a Koreatown apartment, you know, with thumping music, a la Vincent walking into that yeah. nightclub to see Tone Loke. It's, my brother Rich is going to talk to you, Richard Tarina. And so he's there, and again, another sort of semi-familiar landscape to us, but it's just another thing of like, he's obligated, he's got to get him out, and he has these alliances. And I think that that's what makes Nate different and makes this crew different, is because their alliances go beyond death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they work in this and they still live lives.
Yes, yeah. And I like you speaking of Nate's place. I like that we have the recency of Tokyo Vice to sort of like to call up that. I mean, I don't know if you did, but like every time it described the neon coming through the window blinds and things, yeah. like I just pictured a lot of those scenes in Tokyo Vice. And I'm glad that the book keeps emphasizing that it's K-pop thumping through the walls. Otherwise, my brain would have still been playing House of Pain from 2 a.m. With Richard and Albert. And I do like, just before we leave Nate and Chris, I like that even after the reality of Neil's death hits Chris, that he still asks, did Neil get Waingro? Like that's still on his mind. Like, that at least there's, you know, maybe
it was one last, it was one last closed door. Well, also that question for me also, and I wonder if it's for you, but it's like, it's also a threat.
Right. 100%.
Because Waingro, now he's the most vulnerable. There's no crew around him. There's no team. He's shot. Right. And Waingro, even knowing Nate or having a handle on some of that community, he becomes a problem, because if he decides that he wants to start stirring up even more trouble, then Chris has to keep his eye out for Waingro.
Yeah,
on top of all of the LAPD after shooting Bosco.
Yeah. So when you mentioned how the Vincent discovering Edie on the surveillance, like that moment, I would talk something about a jolt going through Vincent or something.
Mm.
Like, it, even though we don't want anything bad to happen to Edie, like, we know Hannah is so well fleshed out that we are excited for him. Like, we are excited anytime he gets a little lead like that. You know, it's like hearing Slick or, you know, knowing Hugh Benny dimed him on the bank heist. Like, we're with him. Like, yes, Vincent got another lead. You know, the chase continues. And then also, you know, I was trying to put together, we talk about how long the movie is, but how long Vincent's been up at this point. Because he was, you know, he was, Neil was in the wind, bye-bye. He was going to go to his hotel and sleep for a month. But then Lauren, and so then he was at the hospital.
Yeah, he's running 30, he'd be 36 hours.
At least 36, that was what I was thinking. Somewhere between 36 and 48 hours.
And look, like, I did the same thing to go see Heat. I was essentially away for 36
fair play.
Hours.
Well, yeah.
So if by the end, when I was getting off into that cab in New York City, if I look like a fucking lunatic, that's exactly why. Because
I was hoping you got to take a stand-up nap at FAO's World. Checking out. And you know, when he discovers Edie and sort of makes that connection, it's also a moment where we kind of remember that Vincent isn't all-knowing. Like, for as far as he knows, Edie is an accomplice and sheltering Chris. And, you know, he doesn't know off the bat that she's, you know, for the most part, a bystander.
The last time he sees that crew coupled up, like when they first say, who's the loner, like that first Neil moment, Neil doesn't have a partner there.
True. Yeah.
And everyone, with the greatest respect to all those ladies, Elaine, Charlene, they've already caught and tried to use to leverage to get Chris. You imagine that Elaine and the kids are being interviewed or something like that, in some respect. They've seen Anna and Treo. Right. Like, you know, if they haven't seen them yet, or they've been told that, we assume that they were told about them with Hugh Benny, because they definitely know that, you know, the guy that they're on is gone. They know that Breeden's dead. So there's kind of all this fallout of everything that's been going on. Waingro's dead. And so now discovering her just means, like, if you were his presumption, which I think is absolutely fair, is like, if you were coupled up with this crew, you know that they don't do this for a living. You know that they don't sell metal.
Yeah. Sell metal kitchen cabinets or something. Yeah. The whole scene with Edie, you could, you know, it depends. I know we'll maybe talk a bit about casting. You'll get into it in future episodes, I know, but it's just so hard the way it's written here seems tailor-made for 1995 Amy Brenneman performance of that sort of, what did I write down? There's a passage about her seeming like a doe headed into busy traffic or something.
Yeah, yes.
And I was like, that is just perfect. Like,
that's her.
She just flirts with this guy she's seen in a bookstore and just had no idea where things would turn from there. So yeah, that was a great, that's a great characterization.
And I love that they focus on this line. She nods. He said, when it rains, you get wet. Michael knew the risks. Yeah. It's just like, that's one of the things. When it rains, you get wet.
And she did, so did I. Which I thought of when they were talking about Dr. Bob. I was like, I wish there was a flip side. I was like, when it pains, you get vet.
See, this is why you're the chief meme officer of One 8 Minute Productions. When it rains, you get vet.
I need whatever happens with the rest of the casting. I need Jeremy Piven to make a teeny a teeny cameo just to deliver that line somehow.
So funny. We go to Nate's bar and we learn that it's called the Blue Room.
The Blue Room, which I can't think of a more perfect name for
a Michael Mann bar.
A bar in a Michael Mann movie. I love that scene. I love that, you know, at first it seems like nobody is surprised that the LAPD burst through the door of that place. Like, it's not their first visit.
It's not their first rodeo with an LA raid.
Yes. Yeah. And I liked, you know, well, first of all, the line, he smells like brute and dry cleaned polyester is absolutely what I always imagined every scene with me. Like when they're in the car together, or, you know, when they're back at his house, like add stale beer into the mix, probably at the bar. And so I love that line. And I like that we see somebody that Vincent can't immediately get off base, you know, like Nate's one person he doesn't immediately rattle.
Vincent's doing the thing with Nate and he goes, if you got cause, arrest me. If not, your presence is discouraging my midday business.
Yeah. Elude? Do I elude you? I was actually a little disappointed that I think at one point, you know, he says, you know, how do you know Neil McCauley? And Nate says, who? And I wanted him to go, what are you, a fucking owl? I was happy and disappointed that there was that there wasn't such a direct callback. Like that would be a bit Star Wars prequel on the nose to do that. But Vincent doesn't get Neil too off base when they go to Cape Mantellini, but he's not doing the give me all you got, Vincent. Like
he's not fighting also.
Right.
He's not fighting with Nate. Nate would have a presence. Like we can render how big and full of life like 95 John Voight is, and how much that would be like he's a peer, like an older brother fraternally, right, to Neil. And so it's like your younger brother snapping at you. He's just like, I'm not fucking intimidated by you. And like, right. And again, speaking of not their first rodeo, this is not my first rodeo that I've been interrogated by cops. And if you don't have cause to say that I'm, you know, you say that a woman came over and saw me talking to this man. What did I talk to him about? Did any exchange of information? Did I pass him any details? Did I do anything like that?
Right.
She may have heard me talk on the phone. It wasn't surveilled. It's all like, what is it? Plausible deniability. So he's not worried. He's not worried. Yeah. It's not like people can just go call up all these things, like, you know, they're not gonna get him.
No, we're pretty confident he's covered his tracks.
Yes, definitely.
Even as Vincent works his network of informants as the
yes, eluding.
Yeah.
I do like how Vincent describes him as waste of time. This guy's like talking to last week's roadkill. Such a great line. And then we start to see Chris on the road going south. We get our Mexicali mentions. We start moving. This is where we're sort of streaming towards the border.
Yeah, I love the great move of Frida. What's we calling her?
Frida
Kahlo. Calling her brother, who looks enough like Chris in the end. Just to do follow, and just the whole interaction at the border, like Mr. Shiny Glasses or whatever they call it, I Am God. Like it's almost as if Chris is narrating the whole encounter.
The big part here is that he calls Charlene.
Right, which is pretty bold. I would assume
kind of stupid.
Even after she waves him off that they would still be on her phone, even if they don't pick up, you know, the 1995 satellite phone or whatever it was at the time.
I think this is the other thing we've got to remember. Like in 95, if they don't have her, they keep her all night in a police safe house down by Venice.
Yeah.
They release her to go. She's probably facing some further questioning and we'll have to come in and formally do stuff. But the fact that he can get in contact with her and then he does is like, it feels like a nice coda to that moment because I don't think you need it, but I think you need it now in this. You don't need it in the film, certainly, but you need it in this moment of like, this is a final reminder of like what he's actually lost, because it's Charlene and Dominic. And in the Charlene scene, it's just all wordless. They're communicating with hand gestures that, you know, the meaning is significant to them and them only. And so that, you know, he's like, if you've got to get away and you basically have one chance to talk to her and here's her number, but that's it. You've got to go and you basically can't talk to her for, you know, at least 6 months. Like, you've got to stay the hell away.
Right. And we do get, like you mentioned, a bit more of a foreshadowing of the Mexicali. How he's going back. I can't go in. Fuck no. It just has to come back around to this place, doesn't it? I'm not going backward into the fire, into nothing. And then she keeps reassuring him they're not staying there.
Yes. It's just a border crossing.
Yeah. I'm realizing as I was rereading, I sort of had stopped making notes so much. I was just getting into the story. And like, can't make notes now. I'm traveling into Mexico with Jeffrey Bergman?
Yeah, with Jeff Bergman and a woman who looks like she can bench press a Chrysler.
Yes. Yeah. I love that. And they don't, at least the way it reads, that the whole act with her grandmother having a stroke and everything, you know, we don't get the backstory of them planning that. Like, if that was improvised on the fly, like, well done. Like, that was you know, as someone who's performed improv before, like, that's quite a good yes and collaboration.
But speaking as a Chicagoan, you guys are, you know, so big in your community of improv. It's like, yeah, absolutely. Right. Yes. Yeah. And how many times have we had to trick cops to sneak criminals over the border? A lot.
Exactly. Exactly.
Essentially, we end one line or a line before the last two sentences is somehow, someday I'll be back.
Hmm.
And, you know, framing up, I guess, the entire conceit of the story that Chris is still out there. And then one day he may encounter Vincent Hanna again. One day he'll come back to LA and then shit's going to go down. And eventually we get there.
You know, I like that it drops us right into the story where we left off, as if we never left. And it's just a great weaving of the end of the movie, you know, into this new story. And like I said, I almost kind of imagine as an extended deleted scene, you know, if you like that could have just as easily, you know, if the script was another 30 pages, like these are the 30 pages. Basically.
And now we've got a special call in from One Heat Minute Productions crew member and patron, Marissa Buxbaum. A terrific theory about the parallels between Vincent Hanna and one Michael Corleone.
Michael Mann has done something pretty crafty with the subtext in Heat 2, the metatext of Al Pacino, really, which is to present us with a series of major parallels that combine for what I like to call the Michael Corleone theory of Vincent Hanna. Exhibit A. They're both intense, intelligent, and Italian, and the youngest of three biological siblings. Exhibit B, both are war veterans who voluntarily enlisted. C, Vincent Hanna's father was a former bootlegger who was injured in the throat during a shootout, causing him to speak in a rasp afterward. That's about as subtle as a 2x4 right there. D, both have former wives who were killed tragically inside a car. Not to mention that Vincent's wife suffered from repeat miscarriages, and as for Kay, well, she said it was a miscarriage. E, and this one's my favorite, the memory image or the dream image of a silent banquet table during wartime. That scene where Michael is left alone at the table at the end of The Godfather Part 2, contrasted with the revelation in Heat 2 that the dream template from the diner scene actually originates in Vietnam with the dead bodies of a family who quote-unquote preferred a dignified suicide. F. Michael Corleone crosses the moral event horizon. You could argue that he does this twice, actually, once at the end of part one and again at the end of part two of The Godfather, with the execution of Fredo, his brother. Vincent Hanna crosses the existential event horizon when he kills Neil, who is nothing if not symbolically just as close. Both experience a spiritual death as a result, and much of Heat 2 is Vincent Hanna spiraling further downward into dangerous impulsivity, substance abuse, and further alienation from his family. So is this guy something or is he something? You can get even more granular than this, which I won't do, but it's there and it's laid on too thick to be coincidental. Combined with the abundant imagery pairing Vincent with symbols of death and damnation, a carrion bird with a grin like a reaper's scythe, a trip down the freeway Styx for a fiery final showdown with the demonic Wardell, Heat 2 paints an even darker portrait of my favorite obsessive police detective than was suggested by the film.
That concludes this episode of the Heat 2 Book Club on One Heat Minute and One Heat Minute Productions. I've been your host, Blake Howard. Huge special thank you to John P. Glynn for doing the lion's share of the deconstruction of both the prologue and part one, Los Angeles, with me. Huge thank you to Stu Coote, whom without him, this entire expedition would not exist. And a big, big extra special thank you to Marissa Buxbaum, one of our newest patrons and crew members, for sharing that amazing theory and taking so much time and effort and thought to really get in and be a part of the show. If you love what we're doing, check out oneheatminute.com. If you want to get in touch, it's mail@oneheatminute.com. If you want to be a patron and join Marissa and send voice memos and be new callers on any of these episodes of the Heat 2 Book Club, patreon.com/oneheatminute, and you'll instantly be made part of the crew as soon as you do that. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to catching up with you again in about a week's time for this episode. We have 6 amazing episodes. We have incredible guests. We've got part 2 coming next week, the lion's share of that deconstruction with Guy Davis. But until next time, we'll catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner.
And it feels like such a 20th century movie. It feels like something David Lean would have done or tried to do when he still had that kind of currency. And even then, he might not have succeeded.
It's incredible because, like, if you don't have time to watch all 5 seasons of Lost, you can just watch Fearless.
Not a week goes by that I don't think of the ending of Gallipoli. It's left a mark. A Year of Living Dangerously. And then something like Last Wave, even, that's so deeply embedded with the land and the story of the land, the story of place. You know, I don't know that I'd seen very many movies at that point in my life that had such a down ending, and they had such a, you know, sort of strong sense of folklore attached to it as that. And something always so poetic and lyrical about Peter Weir's work.
Gallipoli was the first movie that ever traumatized me, and I don't think I ever really recovered from it. And I'm still upset that they played it in school. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to make they say it's not possible to make an anti-war movie, but I think Peter Weir pulled it off.
Yes.
Because no one watches that movie then thinks, I want to go to war.
Peter Weir is the greatest director that Australia has ever produced. Like, bar none, hands down. Like, no one else is even in the room.
I think you have covered some really titanic filmmakers and some really titanic films so far, but I truly think what makes Peter Weir special and what makes you doing this one special is we don't talk about Peter Weir that way, and we should. Peter Weir is one of those guys who I don't get why he isn't a bigger name, why he isn't more in that rarefied air, because I think film for film, he's one of our very best filmmakers. He has brought his A game repeatedly to many properties. There are films of his that I hold very dear. Fearless, The Mosquito Coast. I will fight somebody if they talk bad about The Mosquito Coast. It's, man, I love that movie. But in general, I just think he is a special filmmaker, a smart, lyrical, hallucinatory filmmaker. He's a very dreamy filmmaker, and I don't think he gets his due.
You know, Master and Commander is one of my all-time favorite movies. Easily one of the best movies of the last 20 years. It's, there's a grand scale. There's a historical backdrop to it. But at the same time, there's such an intimacy in the relationships.
Which I think is not just a great film and one of the last great epics in the truest sense. I think is actually kind of a sliding doors change point moment in cinema history. I think 2003, when that comes along, and it is an old-fashioned, we don't make them like that anymore type film. I think if Master and Commander spawns a franchise at that point, the entire cinema landscape globally is completely different.
That's the movie that I wanted to see 10 of those, you know. And yeah, I know they're big fans of Fast and Furious and everything, and God bless you, but Master and Commander should have been.
It's one of those things. Again, I am not I'm not a seafaring man, sir. But there is a sense of authenticity. There's a sense of really watching a genuine dedication to recreating history unfold on a big screen in front of you that can't help but inspire just genuine admiration and awe.
If you're going to pick a film where he really brings every one of his skills to the table, it's Master and Commander. I think you picked the right one, man.
Yeah, very excited to see what you pull out of this, Blake.
That's right. Our next series is Peter Weir and Russell Crowe's Master and Commander. The series is called Podcaster and Commander.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.